And so that brings us to the final chapter of the unit, which is about photosynthesis. And keep in mind the reciprocal relationship between photosynthesis and what we just got done studying, the complete oxidation of glucose. They undo each other, right? The outputs of photosynthesis are the inputs into the complete oxidation of glucose. The outputs of complete oxidation of glucose are the inputs into photosynthesis. Now, that does not mean that the two operate as the same pathway, just run in reverse. They take different ways to get from their beginning to ending points. It's not simply the reverse of the complete oxidation of glucose, but it is, if you think about it, as a summary reaction, which we'll talk more about in a minute. The opening slide just shows you some pictures of representative photosynthetic organisms. We always pretty much automatically think of plants, and that's because we live on land, and so we tend to forget that most of life is in the ocean still, and that's where it started. But land plants are definitely, nowadays, a huge fraction of the photosynthetic organisms. There are plenty still available in the oceans, though, in water. Not only eukaryotes, plants, of course, are eukaryotes, but they're not the only photosynthetic eukaryotes. If you have a eukaryotic organism that is not a plant, but is photosynthetic, it is called an alga, the plural of which is algae. And so there's all kinds of different algae. There's brown, red, and so on. And some of them can be enormous, but they have photosynthetic ability as well because they have chloroplasts just like plants do. Remember, though, when we talked about the endosymbiotic theory, that bacteria invented cellular respiration and they became the mitochondria in eukaryotes. Bacteria also invented photosynthesis long before there were any eukaryotes. And some of those got swallowed and survived and became the first chloroplasts. So there are still plenty of photosynthetic bacteria as well, cyanobacteria and so on. We're going to focus on plants, though, even though what we're learning in this chapter happens more or less in terms of the important things that happen, more or less the same way in all photosynthetic organisms, except that if we're talking about prokaryotes, they, of course, don't have organelles. A photosynthetic prokaryote, a bacterium, is going to do the same stuff we're talking about just in its only compartment it has, which is its cell. It doesn't have a chloroplast. But in eukaryotes that are photosynthetic, which means algae and plants, that process occurs entirely within chloroplasts. Unlike the previous chapter, by the way, the reciprocal process, complete oxidation of glucose, remember, occurs in eukaryotes in two chambers because glycolysis is in the cytoplasm and cellular respiration is in the mitochondrion. Well, for photosynthesis, the entire thing occurs within the one chamber, the chloroplast. So if we look at a leaf, and for a typical plant, the leaf is the primary photosynthetic organ. For any given plant, any green part of it is capable of photosynthesis because what makes it look green to us is a photosynthetic pigment called chlorophyll, which is what captures the light. In most plants, the greenest part are the leaves. But there are exceptions, especially where we live. Cacti evolved to... They changed their leaves into defense structures, spines, that don't photosynthesize. They're usually whitish. But notice that the whole trunk of the plant is the green part. That's where the photosynthesis is occurring. Usually it's a leaf, though, in a typical plant. And if you look at a leaf, it's arranged more or less like a sandwich. where the two pieces of bread are layers of cells called epidermal cells, just like the epidermis of our skin. It's a coating, and it keeps it from drying out. It's a waterproof coating, but it can't be a complete seal. There has to be passageways in it because you need to let the gases through. The gases for photosynthesis are the same as the gases for cellular respiration. It's just that they're reversed with respect to what is put in and what is taken out. CO2, which is a waste product, an output of complete oxidation of glucose, is actually what's required for photosynthesis. So that's why CO2 is shown going in. And oxygen is spit out as a waste product. But anyway, this otherwise good seal in this epidermis is perforated or filled with holes that are called stomata. That's the plural of the word stoma. One of them is a stoma, which means mouth. They're just little openings, though. The stomata are not actually structures. They're just the spaces between specialized pairs of cells called guard cells, which can change how much they're... By osmosis, they can change to be either swollen or flaccid and therefore open or close the stoma. So leaves can control how much gas exchange there is. They want to be open. They can't close up permanently because they can't get any CO2, which is required for photosynthesis. But on the other hand, they don't want to be completely open all the time because they'll dry out by losing water. Anyway, the filling of the sandwich between the two slices is primarily made up of these green cells in the cartoon version. Now, not the entire cell is green, but what makes it look green is because these cells have a lot of chloroplasts in them. And the cells in this inner layer make up what is called the mesophyll layer. Phyll, P-H-Y-L-L, means leaf. And meso means middle, so it's the middle of the leaf, middle of the thickness of the leaf. And these mesophyll cells are where most of the photosynthesis occurs. The cell itself is not green, though. We're looking at one mesophyll cell here in detail. What really makes it look green is that there are a bunch of chloroplasts, and one chloroplast in detail is shown here. Keep in mind what we've already talked about. Just like a mitochondrion, a chloroplast is a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. Well, there's really two membranes, but we name it as three. We give three names to it. There's an outer membrane, just big enough to cover it smoothly. And then there's an inner membrane. But there's a third name that we call the thylakoid membrane. It's really just an elaboration or an infolding of the inner membrane. This inner membrane is continuous with the thylakoid membrane. But it's the thylakoid membrane that contains a bunch of chlorophyll pigment, which is what makes it look green to us. We've talked about the thylakoids before. We're seeing a cutaway view again. Remember that thylakoids are not separate from each other. Each little flattened sac is really, when you look at the cutaway view, continuous as far as the space in it with all the others. So there is one continuous and elaborate thylakoid space, as it's called. There's three compartments in a chloroplast. There's an intermembrane space between the outer and inner membrane. There is the stroma, which is the fluid inside the inner membrane. And be careful with that word. Stroma is totally different from stoma. Okay, but the stroma is this fluid. And then there's the compartment inside the thylakoids, and that's called the thylakoid space. Slide 3. What we're looking at here are reactants and products for the overall process of photosynthesis. In the last chapter, we looked at a summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose. Not because it happens in one step, but because you can skip the details to summarize it and just start or show the starting materials as reactants in a one-step reaction and show the final products as the products, right? Do you remember what the summary reaction for complete oxidation of glucose is? What do you have to have as inputs? Keeping in mind that the name of it is the complete oxidation of glucose. Glucose is one input, and that's C6H12O6. What else do you need? Oxygen. And that becomes what? Carbon dioxide, right? That's completely spent fuel. And what? Water. And to balance it, you have one glucose, six oxygens, six carbon dioxides, and six waters. Okay, now we just got done talking about the fact that that does not happen in one step. It happens in many steps. But that summarizes the reciprocal reaction compared to photosynthesis. Well, photosynthesis, since it's reciprocal, can also be written as a summary reaction that would be exactly the reverse. So you start with water and carbon dioxide, and you produce oxygen and glucose. Okay? You can see that the way they have it arranged here as well, except that water is a little bit more complicated than that. Water, notice, is both an input and an output. You're putting 12 waters in, and you're getting 6 out, and therefore you could just simplify it by subtracting 6 from both sides. And that then it turns into exactly this. All right? So with a rightward arrow, that would be the summary reaction for complete oxidation of glucose. If you wrote it the other way around, it's the summary reaction for photosynthesis. When you write it the way they have here, though, it's nice to look at these arrows because, for instance, the oxygen that is produced by photosynthesis, you might think, well, that comes from CO2. Well, actually, no, it doesn't. The oxygen comes from water. And speaking of reciprocal relationship between the two processes, think about last chapter. When we take in oxygen for the purpose of cellular respiration, it picks up the electrons and protons from the fuel, right, as hydrogen atoms, and becomes water. Well, that's exactly the opposite of what's happening here. In a photosynthetic organism, water is a source of hydrogens. We'll talk more about that. And what's left over is oxygen. And while I'm still here, I want to remind, I think I've said this before, but it's really important. So I'll say again that the truly important thing that photosynthesis is accomplishing is to produce organic compounds using an inorganic source of carbon. That's the thing that no consumer in the world can do, including us and all animals. That's why we cannot live without producers, because we have to take our carbon in already in organic form. CO2 is worthless to us. But to a producer, CO2, which is inorganic, is a source of carbon to make their own organic compounds. All right? Now, what is that process called? The incorporation of an inorganic source of carbon into organic compounds. You remember what I said that is called? Looks like no. It's called carbon fixation. So that, it's not just plants. Any photosynthetic organism, and as a matter of fact, any producer, which includes chemosynthetic as well, they do it using something other than light as as the energy source, but they still fix carbon. That's the important thing that they do. And this is inorganic, this is organic. That's carbon fixation. All right, now to four. This is a summary slide, just like we started the process in last chapter with a summary slide. Notice, though, that we don't have cytosol being shown here because everything, all parts of photosynthesis occur within the chloroplast, assuming it's a eukaryotic cell, which we are. So the chloroplast is this, of course. And photosynthesis has many steps to it, but you can think of it as occurring in two major parts, which you can see here listed. This book calls them the light reactions and the Calvin cycle. They have gone by different names over the years. They used to be called the light reactions and the dark reactions. You don't find those terms anymore unless you intentionally go back to an old textbook, decades old. The problem with calling something the dark reactions is it kind of implies that darkness is required, but it's not. So the better names for these are the light-dependent reactions, which specifically says light is required, and the light-independent reactions, meaning that those will happen whether there's light or not. All right? But the most important part of the light-dependent reactions is a biochemical cycle called the Calvin cycle, named after Calvin, of course. And so you can use the phrase Calvin cycle or light-independent reactions interchangeably. They refer to exactly the same thing. And this book says light reactions, but it's better to say light-dependent reactions. Okay, those are the two major parts of photosynthesis. If we think about it in terms of goals, like we did for last chapter, the goal of photosynthesis is to produce organic compounds. Specifically, the organic compounds that are produced are sugars. But once a photosynthetic organism has sugars, it can use those as a source to make the other kinds of organic compounds, whether they're amino acids or, you know, the things that we've been talking about earlier in the term. The point is you have to get to an organic compound first, and then you can make all the others. Well, the goal, the sugar, is the output of the second part of photosynthesis, the light-independent reactions, or the Calvin cycle produces the sugar. And, by the way, it is not actually glucose that's produced directly by the Calvin cycle. Glucose is a 6-carbon compound. The Calvin cycle directly produces a 3-carbon compound. But once you have that, you can combine them into glucose. And that's why glucose can still be considered the overall product. Anyway, the goal is realized or met in this second part. But think about what it means to build a complex multi-carbon sugar using a simple 1-carbon CO2 molecules as your raw material. How would you describe that process in terms of metabolism? What's the word that would refer to that? It's an anabolic process, exactly. Because you're building up more complex things out of smaller, less complex things. Okay? Just the opposite of breaking something down, which would be catabolism. This is anabolism. Now, what have you learned goes hand in hand with anabolic? What do you expect an anabolic process to be in terms of energy? Endergonic, exactly. It requires energy. That's never going to happen on its own, which brings up the third word, right? Non-spontaneous. You have to force this to happen. And therefore, there needs to be an outside energy source, right? It's not going to happen on its own. Well, that's why you need the first part of photosynthesis. The light-dependent reactions are a way for the photosynthetic organism to get the energy required to drive the Calvin cycle, or light-independent reactions, which is the part that actually makes the sugar. Well, it probably won't surprise you that ATP is involved, because it's such a versatile energy storage molecule. But while it is true that the Calvin cycle requires ATP, it can't operate without ATP, ATP is not enough. It's one of two forms of energy, or energy-carrying molecules, I should say, that the Calvin cycle requires. In addition to ATP, it also requires a version of a reduced coenzyme that we haven't talked about yet, but is very similar to the ones that we have talked about. Photosynthetic organisms use NADPH. That's the reduced form. Now, it operates exactly the same way that NADH does, except it also has a phosphate group on it. Okay? So, plants, for instance, as a representative photosynthetic organism, you can kind of think of them as having two different fleets of taxis. They have an NAD fleet, which they use in their own mitochondria for the process that we just covered in the previous chapter. And then they have a specialized fleet for photosynthesis that are just like it, except they have phosphate. The reduced form of the one for cellular respiration, remember, is NAD+. The oxidized form. The oxidized form for the photosynthetic version is NADP+. So the P is the only difference. Okay, NADP plus is the oxidized form. It becomes reduced into NADPH and H plus. But importantly, these both carry energy, but neither of them is sufficient to drive the Calvin cycle. The Calvin cycle will not happen unless it's supplied with both of these energy-carrying molecules. And that's why the light reactions, or the light-dependent reactions, have to produce both of these energy-carrying molecules. That's shown here with the green arrows coming out of the light reactions. Now, producing ATP and NADPH, reduced coenzyme, is itself expensive, right? There has to be an energy source to make those. Like when we made ATP and NADH in the previous chapter, the energy source was the fuel, the food. Well, here the goal is to make the food. So you wouldn't burn food to make ATP and NADPH to make food. The source of energy is the light that's coming in. So light is the energy input, and by the way, the summary reactions would be energy on this side. You have to input energy for photosynthesis, running this in reverse. For the complete oxidation of glucose, you run it to the right and you output energy, right? Okay, so light is energy, and if it can be captured, some of it's lost as heat, of course. But some of that energy can be put into building molecules of ATP and NADPH. Both are the requirements to allow the Calvin cycle to run, which fixes the carbon that's in CO2 into organic compounds, three carbon sugars and eventually glucose. When Calvin cycle does that, meaning does the carbon fixation part, powered by these energy-carrying molecules, it's of course going to spend these energy-carrying molecules. When you spend ATP, it's going to dephosphorylate it back into ADP and inorganic phosphate. When you spend the reduced coenzyme NADPH, you're going to strip it of its hydrogens and turn it back into NADP+, the oxidized form. So these lower energy versions of these energy carrying molecules then can drive back to the light dependent reactions and get recharged with energy. NADPH gets re-reduced into NADPH. NADP plus gets re-reduced into NADPH, and ADP and inorganic phosphate get synthesized back into ATP. The only thing I really haven't mentioned here is the inputs and outputs into the light reaction. Well, I mentioned some of the outputs. The light reactions has material inputs in the form of the NADP plus and the ADP and inorganic phosphate, right? Because that's the whole purpose, is to energize both of those kinds of molecules. But it also has as a material input water. And I said in a different slide that water for photosynthesis is a source of hydrogens. The reason that you need the hydrogens, as we'll see in detail in a different slide, is really as a source of electrons. Just like the hydrogens in the previous chapter that are stripped from fuel are a source of electrons that pay off in the electron transport chain, similar things going to happen here. So what plants are able to do, in photosynthetic organisms in general, is split water so that you get the hydrogens off of it, and then those hydrogens are split into electrons and protons. When you do that, what's left over is oxygen. That's why oxygen is just a waste product from the viewpoint of photosynthesis. It's why it spits it out. All right? Now, none of this can happen, though, unless you provide energy in the form of light. Another thing that's similar or reciprocal to the previous chapter is the energetic intermediary, the energy currency, right? I said that we don't burn our fuels to directly power our endergonic processes, right? Instead, the energy released by burning our fuels gets put into storage as ATP temporarily, and then the ATP is used to power the process. Similarly here, the Calvin cycle can't directly take light energy as its source to produce the sugar. It needs energy specifically in the form of ATP and NADPH. And therefore, light energy gets transduced into the energy of ATP and NADPH. Five. In five, we're looking at the electromagnetic spectrum. Light is energy, but specifically, in terms of form, light is electromagnetic energy. And the name electromagnetic implies that there is an electrical and a magnetic component to the energy, which is true. That's why it's called that. But we use the word light different ways sometimes. All light is electromagnetic radiation. And you can use the two interchangeably sometimes. But sometimes when we say light, we really mean humanly visible light. Well, humanly visible light is really only a tiny portion of the overall spectrum of electromagnetic radiation. It's all the same stuff, whether it's visible to us or not. But only this little sliver is visible to us. It's weird stuff, electromagnetic radiation. There is a duality of nature to it, meaning that it's like two different things at the same time. In some ways, it acts as a wave. It has wave-like properties. And in other ways, it acts as a particle. Little particles of energy that don't have any mass. It's not made of matter. But we call those photons. So it has particle nature and wave-like nature. If we think about something that occurs in waves, then we can define what's called a wavelength. As the name implies, it's a distance or a length. It's simply the distance from one part of the wave to the next part in the repeating pattern. And That's really the only thing that makes these different categories of electromagnetic energy different from each other. It's all the same stuff. But the wavelengths can be long or very short. All right? Well, look at the... We have a very wide range of wavelengths here. 10 to the negative fifth nanometers. A nanometer is tiny, and this is 1/100,000th of one of those. That's a tiny wavelength. Over here we have thousands of meters. Very long wavelength. Well, these long wavelengths are radio waves. These are going through our body all the time. It would make radios work. It's light. We just can't see it because the wavelength isn't right for those photons to interact with our eyes. If you get a little longer, those are microwaves. Same microwaves that heat food in ovens or that run your cell phone. We can't see those either. They're a little shorter wavelengths, though. Then we get infrared, which is called infrared, meaning just below red, because it's still invisible. The longest wavelengths that we can see are the red end, and therefore longer than that would be infrared. But when we're in this range, which is roughly from 400 to 750 nanometers, that's humanly visible light. It's not any different from radio waves or anything else, except the wavelength is just detectable by our eyes. Okay, so here's where we have Roy G. Biv, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Then you can get even shorter wavelengths that are now invisible on the other end. And that's why this is called UV, ultraviolet. It's above violet. Well, when you get shorter wavelength light, it becomes more energetic. And this is why UV starts getting dangerous. Ultraviolet light causes skin cancer, right? That's why you should minimize your exposure to it in sunlight. But there's far more dangerous stuff. If you get even shorter wavelengths, that's X-rays, also causes cancer. Even more dangerous than that are gamma rays. But thankfully, the gamma rays are mostly filtered out before they hit Earth. They're coming from the sun, though. Anyway, that's the entire spectrum. This humanly visible portion, I'm not telling you this because we're studying humans or vision. We're not. We're studying photosynthesis. But because of the way evolution has worked, plants use roughly the same range of wavelengths that we do for vision, except they're using that for absorbing those photons to provide an energy source for the light-dependent reactions. Okay, so let's talk about pigments, slide 6. Pigment means a specific thing. You might think of pigment just as being a synonym of color, but a pigment, chemically speaking, or physically speaking, is a substance that absorbs photons within the humanly visible range. Now, I just said that a photon is a single packet of light energy. So when you say, when light is streaming in, that's quadrillions and quadrillions of photons, each carrying a little bit of energy. When a photon encounters an object, there's three basic possibilities. One is that it will just be transmitted through the object, like light coming through a window. Right? Just goes through it. Another possibility is that it is reflected, meaning it will bounce off of that object and go in a different direction. And the third possibility is that the photon will be absorbed. Well, if a photon gets absorbed, it ceases to exist. The photon is destroyed when it's absorbed. But recall the first law of thermodynamics. Energy can't be destroyed, right? The photon's carrying energy, so when the photon gets destroyed, the energy is not destroyed. But the energy goes into the thing that absorbed it. This is why photosynthesis works. Photosynthetic organisms, in other words, need to absorb photons in order to get the energy for the light-dependent reactions to turn ADP into ATP and NADP plus into NADPH. Well, not all of the light gets absorbed. Plants do a good job at absorbing photons in the blue and the red range, those two ends of the humanly visible spectrum. Green is in the middle of that, and plants don't do a very good job of absorbing green light. Instead, green just gets reflected off of them, bounced. Well, this is why plants look green to us. We often say that a plant is green. Well, the plant is actually not green. The greenness is an event that happens in our brain. It's a sensation. White light, which is what's coming from the sun, is a mixture of all colors, all wavelengths of light, and wavelengths correspond to colors in our sensation. All of them mixed together make it white. That's why you have white light coming in. So that includes photons with blue wavelengths, red, all the colors. When they encounter the chloroplast in a leaf, the plant will absorb most of the red and blue ends. And so, as I said, absorption destroys those photons. Those are no longer there. The green ones, though, do not get absorbed. They get reflected. And so if we're looking at this, we don't see the white light because all of the red and blue have been removed. Only the green comes back to us, and that's why it looks green to us. Objects don't actually have the color, though. The color is happening in our brain. Okay, 7. On the top graph, we see 3 absorption spectra. That's just the plural of spectrum. It's 3 graphs in one. Each of these different colored traces could be its own graph. But an absorption spectrum is just a graph of absorption of light versus wavelength of the light, which corresponds to the color. Okay, so the short wavelength end of the humanly visible spectrum, and also the important part for the plants, is the 400 range. That's the bluish end. The reddish end is 700. And what you see here is, in graphic form, is what I told you in the previous slide. Plants do well at absorbing things in the blue range and the red range, but not in the green range. Almost no absorption of green here. Well, chlorophyll is the chief photosynthetic pigment. And that's a word that linguistically means green leaf. Phyll, as I said, means leaf, like in the word I used before. Chloro means green. That's why chlorine was named. It's greenish gas. But anyway, chlorophyll is just one pigment. It's the most important pigment for photosynthesis. And there are 2 major versions of just chlorophyll. Chlorophyll A and B. They each have their own trace here. Notice, though, that they don't have identical absorption spectrums. A is good, is best at this color, at absorbing. Chlorophyll B is best at this. And then plants also have a set of other pigments, collectively called accessory pigments, because they help out chlorophyll. They do the same thing. They're trying to absorb photons, but they absorb in still other ranges. And the chief accessory pigments are called carotenoids. Well, if you have all of these instead of just one, then you're able to capture a bunch more light of various colors. But still, none of them does a good job at green, which is why, you know, if you tried to grow a plant in a closet where it's not getting any light and you gave it nothing but green light, it would just starve. The green light would not be usable by the plant. We can see this in the second graph, which is related. It's called an action spectrum, though. It's still the y-axis is still wavelength or color of light, but what's being plotted here is rate of photosynthesis. What you see here is if you give it blue or red light, it does a lot of photosynthesis, but it doesn't do very much with green light. And the bottom one is yet another way of displaying this, except this is an actual experiment. This is a glass slide that this is being conducted on, a glass slide in a sealed compartment, so it's not open to the air. And you have a filamentous alga, which is a eukaryotic organism that's not a plant, but it's photosynthetic. So this is just a few cells of this alga. And part of it is exposed to different, each part is exposed to a different color of light. In addition to the alga, though, you have aerobic bacteria, which are bacteria that require oxygen just like we do in order to live. And notice that the bacteria thrive on the ends where it's blue and green because in this sealed compartment, the alga is undergoing photosynthesis, producing oxygen, keeping these bacteria alive. But at the green part, it's not undergoing photosynthesis, and therefore there's no oxygen for bacteria here, and they don't grow. Speaking of chlorophyll, slide 8 shows you a diagram of both, in one diagram, really. This is A and B. Notice the only difference is a complex structure, but the only difference between chlorophyll A and B is that this little part is just CH3 in chlorophyll A. It would be CHO in chlorophyll B. That's enough to make a difference, though, with respect to what kind of photons get absorbed by these two versions of chlorophyll. Now, this is a overall pretty huge molecule, right? There's a lot of atoms in it. And by the way, all this stuff up at the top have the atoms explicitly listed, whatever they are, C's, H's, O's. But down here, they aren't. This tail that's hanging off down at the bottom is, of course, still made of atoms, but this just is a shorthand notation used in biochemistry. Did I talk about this before? Okay, so whenever you have a corner, remember that there's a carbon there. And then you just fill it with enough hydrogens to satisfy the valence. So just like we saw, I think when I first mentioned it was when we were talking about fatty acids. Fatty acids are, except for that carboxyl end, fatty acids are hydrocarbons, right? Same with this. Since there's there's no letters, we know that this can't be anything but carbon and hydrogen because of this shorthand notation. So this tail here, this part of the tail is hydrocarbon. And the reason that's important is because these pigments aren't just moving around in the cell. Not only are they within chloroplasts, first of all, but the pigment molecules are specifically embedded in the thylakoid membrane, the membrane that forms all those sac-like structures called thylakoids. That's where all the pigment molecules are anchored or kept in place. Well, what keeps things in membranes? Remember we talked about proteins? Proteins are not chemically bonded to the phospholipids, and the phospholipids are not bonded to each other, right? It's a fluid mosaic. But do you remember what kept the proteins in the membrane? It was because a protein will have parts at its ends that are made of hydrophilic amino acids, and then the part in the thickness of the membrane are hydrophobic. And so that's what keeps it kind of buoyed there. Same with this. The hydrocarbon tail of a chlorophyll is what keeps it in the fatty acid membrane. I mean the phospholipid membrane. Right? Otherwise it would be able to go anywhere in the fluid, and it's not supposed to be allowed to. The green part is also important. It's vitally important because this is the receiving end. This is really where the light gets captured. The tail holds it in place in the membrane, and the green shaded part allows the photons to be absorbed. And that's what delivers the energy for the light-dependent reactions. Okay. Let's go to 9. When I was talking about pigments, I said that a pigment is just something that can absorb photons. That's why pigments look like a color to us, because they're absorbing some photons and reflecting others to our eyes. But remember I said that when a photon is absorbed, it no longer exists. The energy that it used to contain is now put into the pigment that absorbed it. Okay, well, think back to energy levels. And first of all, remember that energy levels are lower the closer you get to the nucleus. The lowest energy level is next to the nucleus, then higher energy levels beyond that. And that's where the electrons are. They're in energy levels, right? Well, in the last chapter, we talked about the fact that electron transport allows those electrons to get to a closer and closer to a nucleus. That's why they're going down in energy, which was the useful source of energy to pump the protons. Here we're looking at a photon striking a pigment molecule, specifically a chlorophyll, but it would be true of other pigments as well. When the photon, if the photon does get absorbed, which, you know, usually it doesn't, but there's so many trillions and trillions of photons that every once in a while you get lucky and have one hit just in the right place to get absorbed. That photon is no longer there, but the energy now goes into exciting the pigment. We say that the pigment is now excited. What that really means is that an electron in that pigment molecule, one of the atoms of the pigment molecule, goes up at least one energy level. Now remember that electrons want to occupy the lowest energy level they can, right? And the reason that not all of the electrons in a big atom can occupy the lowest energy level is because there's a limit to how many they can hold. So any given electron is in as low an energy level, usually, as it can be. But when a photon comes by, it excites an electron and sends it up an energy level. That's why energy is not destroyed. The photon's not there anymore, but now the energy is in this excited electron. And that is a very unstable situation. You go up in G, that means it's less stable. Right? And therefore, the pigment does not want to remain excited. In most pigments, that electron wants to immediately go back down to the lower energy level. And usually it can, and therefore will. A tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of a second later, it's going to go right back down to where it was. Well, that's going to lose energy, right? And so energy is not destroyed. What happens is that to release the energy that it's going to release when it goes back down to the ground state, the lower energy level, a brand new photon gets created to carry that energy away. It's a totally different photon from the one that came in and got absorbed. That's gone forever. And we call this, if this happens, fluorescence. Okay, so the pigment is actually producing its own light, shining it away in order to get the energy out of it that was stored temporarily by the electron when it was excited. Well, if you think about fluorescent paint, it looks very bright, right? Well, that's not because it's reflecting light, it's actually producing its own light. Like the fluorescent paint on speed limit signs. If you're out in the middle of nowhere, away from city lights in the middle of the night, it's really dark. You can't really see anything, but the headlights on a speed limit sign will make it seem like it's its own source of light. It actually is its own source of light. The photons of the headlight get absorbed. Those are gone. That excites the molecules of pigment in the paint. They immediately go back down to lower level and produce their own photons that our eyes pick up. Well, that would be a worthless situation for a plant. Fluorescence would be just a waste of time, right? Because fluorescence doesn't capture any energy. You can make chlorophyll, or I should say chlorophyll just by itself, isolated as chemicals, as individual chlorophyll molecules in suspension, which is what we have here in the flask. If you shine light on those, they will fluoresce. It'll look very bright because they're making their own light. But that would never help the plant, because the idea for the plant is to absorb the energy and put it to use, doing work, specifically producing these energy-carrying molecules, ATP and NADPH. Fluorescence would just be a total waste of the energy that's absorbed. So there couldn't be any photosynthesis. And therefore, obviously, fluorescence must not happen in a plant. It doesn't. The reason that it doesn't happen in a plant, fluorescence, is that the chlorophyll molecules are not just acting independently. They're complexed in a particular way along with proteins in the thylakoid membrane so that fluorescence does not occur and the energy gets harnessed. Okay, and I'll explain that probably the next slide. Yes, slide 10. What we're looking at in 10, the thing that looks like a purple bell pepper that's cut in half, is just a single copy, one of trillions and trillions, a single copy of what's called a photosystem. There are a couple major components to a photosystem. First of all, and this is why it's cut away so you can see the interior, normally these purple things would wrap all the way around, but in the core of one photosystem, in lavender or whatever color this is what's called the reaction center complex. That's part of the photosystem. But then completely surrounding the reaction center complex are several light harvesting complexes, the purple things. All right. Now, the light harvesting complexes, in terms of molecules, are millions and millions of chlorophyll molecules, chlorophyll A, chlorophyll B, also accessory pigments. The pigment molecules are a really important part of the light harvesting complexes, because they are the ones that they're the things that can absorb the photons. But they are complexed along with proteins in such a way that fluorescence will not occur. All right? Now, we have a photon coming by. Notice, it's never just one photon. There are many, many quadrillions of photons, even a tiny bit of light. But we're focusing on this one because this one happens to be lucky enough to hit just in the right place for it to be absorbed by just one of the many pigment molecules in this photosystem. It doesn't have to be this upper left one. It just is in the cartoon. Could be any one of them. It absorbs the photon, and therefore the photon's no longer there, and it excites that chlorophyll molecule. The electron goes up an energy level, right? Normally, if it were on its own, it would just fluoresce, which would be a waste, I'm saying. But because of the way that these are packaged together, instead of fluorescing, the excited pigment, whichever one it is going to transfer its excitation without producing a photon to a nearby pigment that's in that same photosystem. That's this black arrow. Now, it's beyond the scope of this course to explain how that happens, but I can just give you the name of it in this course. It's called resonance energy transfer. Which is the transfer of energy from one pigment to another without fluorescing, without producing
a photon.
Each of these black arrows represents resonance energy transfer. So one of them gets excited, that will excite the next one, that will excite the next one. The excitation keeps bouncing around, basically. Eventually, the excitation will reach a special pair of chlorophyll A molecules that are part of this reaction center complex at the core of the bell pepper. And that special, it's a special pair because when that gets excited, it really gets excited, gets super excited. By which I mean not only do the electrons go up in energy level, the electron actually completely leaves the pigment molecule. That's what E minus means. That's an electron now on its own. It's not part of this pair anymore. Well, the electron gets received by another component of the reaction center complex called the primary electron acceptor. All right? Now, if something is called the primary electron acceptor, what must be going on chemically? What is happening to a primary electron acceptor? It's becoming reduced. Exactly. This is a light-driven redox reaction where the special pair of chlorophyll gets oxidized by being stripped of an electron and the electron acceptor gets reduced. And just like in the previous chapter, something that's reduced is at higher energy. So this reduced primary electron acceptor is now carrying some of the energy that was in the photon that got absorbed. This is how energy gets transduced in the light-dependent reactions. Light is the original source of energy, but the energy gets put into the form of a reduced primary electron acceptor. Now it can be put to work. But that's how a photosystem works. I'm not going to get all the way through 11, but I want to start it. Slide 11 shows you that there are two categories of photosystems in a photosynthetic organism. Now, there's trillions and trillions of copies of each of these, but there's two different categories of photosystems, and they're all embedded in the thylakoid membrane. So that's where you find all of them. But the two categories are reasonably enough, or easy enough to remember, named photosystem 1 and photosystem 2. But it would be nice if it were that simple. It's not. They're called photosystem 1 and photosystem 2, not because that's the order in which they operate. It's actually the opposite order that they operate in. Photosystem 2 works first and then photosystem 1, which seems silly, except that they were named not for the order in which they work. We didn't have that figured out at the time. They were named for the order in which they were discovered. We just happened to discover the second one first. I mean, the one that operates second, we've discovered first. So that's the confusing part of this. Photosystem 2 is first, and then photosystem 1. They're very similar to each other, but they absorb light at slightly different wavelengths, for one thing. The important thing about them, though, is that photosystem 2 and photosystem 1 are functionally linked by what occurs here in between them, which is an electron transport chain. Okay, so there's an electron transport chain between photosystem 2 and photosystem 1. And then there's a shorter electron transport chain after photosystem 1, after the second photosystem, which is called photosystem 1. I'll explain the details next time, but that's the anatomy.